This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County. What a beautiful day. It's about 70 degrees outside. It just makes your energy level just start jumping up. I left Miller's about 2 hours ago. A bunch of people out there having fun and just enjoying the weather.
Must be something wrong with my car thermometer, because mine said it was 96 when I parked.
You're kidding.
Came up here. Came dragging in, feeling like a wet rag.
I noticed you were sweating, and you looked like you'd been outside hauling hay, actually.
Well, I had bush hogging a little this morning.
Of course, everybody knows that Greg Tucker has an endless amount of energy, and I just cannot understand why you look that way today.
I'm here ready to go.
And Brian, you look tired today.
That's just a normal day in paradise, isn't it?
It is paradise. Anytime you're in Rutherford County, it's paradise. It doesn't matter where it's 20 degrees outside or 100 degrees.
There's too much to do. Trying to cram everything in a day, you know, places to go, people to see.
So you're the one that has to do everything. You have to make sure that everything is taken care of 24 hours a day. And is that at the Big G?
Almost. Almost everything.
Well, bless your heart. What if you were in Readable right now? What would you be doing in Readable?
Well, let me tell you.
Sausage and biscuits, gravy and grits, home ground, homemade, it'll get you fits. Blueberry pancakes and corn cakes too, I'm a-licking my lips now, how about you? Readable.
I'll guarantee you it doesn't feel like it's 90 degrees in Readable, especially at the meal, where you're sitting out there where one of the oldest mills in the United States, and one of the very few that's still existing. And, of course, that's thanks to Tom Brady, who refurbished the mill. And it's the only one that I know of that's anywhere close to this area. The last standing one was Brown's Mill, and it's been gone a couple of years. And the Readable Mill sits out at Readable, and the best way to get there is take John Bragg Highway from Murfreesboro and go out about 8 to 10 miles, somewhere like that, and you'll have Cripple Creek on your right, turn left to go on the old Woodbury Highway, and a couple of miles out you'll run into the mill, and that's on Saturday morning from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m., and you'll hear John Blankenship, you just heard his band a few minutes ago, and they're out there every Saturday along with all that great food. And if you want to call in for a reservation, and sometimes that probably is not a bad idea, you can call 563-6455, or you can reach them on the internet, readablemeal.com, and you will have an absolute wonderful time. And Greg and I have been there a number of times.
I always enjoy it.
And I read, and of course, this is interesting to most people, because I think most of the people that listen to the show are really consumed with the history of this area. And I can't think of a more historic area. I mean, we can compete with New England when it comes to history and the things that have changed. And executions, you wrote about that.
Well, you know, there are a lot of things to do around Rutherford County today for entertainment. But in the first 100 years, some of the biggest social events of the county were when there was an execution.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. The first one, I think we mentioned, was about, just 2 years after, about a year after the Murfreesboro was founded in 1813. And it was interesting. The rule back then was, you know, when you built your courthouse, you had to include the stocks and the whipping post and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the gallows was not a standing item. As I was doing the research, I found there were only 3 or 4 executions, hangings in Rutherford County before the Civil War. But they had to, it was the sheriff's job. It was all delegated to the sheriff if the court imposed a sentence. And back then, if someone was found guilty of first-degree murder, there was no choice. It had to be an execution in those early days. And they built that very first gallows right over here on Maple Street, what's now Maple Street, about where the Rover Terminal is. Mm-hmm. On that shares the property there with the Housing Authority. And as several of the historical writings say, it was the first one and was quite a social event. Several thousand turned out for it. It's an interesting sidelight. The superstition back then, and maybe that's part of the reason a lot of them were there, was that if you could get a piece of the hangman's rope that had actually been used, it would ward off certain afflictions.
Mm.
So I don't know how the sheriff decided. Maybe that was a little sideline for the sheriff back then. But someone would obtain the rope and then chop it into a whole bunch of little pieces and sell it. And that rope in particular ended up apparently in a whole lot of households around the county.
You know, I've read your article, and it is extremely interesting to me. And one thing that really stuck out was that taking a person's life legally really didn't carry the feelings that we've got right now. And I'm talking about it didn't have to be a capital crime to hang somebody back then.
Well, that's true.
And we're talking about executions.
Yeah. Yeah,
I read in your article the first one was in 1813.
Right,
and his crime was housebreaking.
That's right. The court had a lot of discretion beyond a capital murder. There was no choice; that was a hanging. But beyond that, there was a host of things, arson in particular, breaking and entering, where the court had the discretion. And I think the first two hangings in this county, neither one involved murder. The old proverbial horse thief was the second one that's documented. And interesting enough, he got a reprieve at the last minute, but he was literally on the gallows with the rope around his neck before he got a reprieve from the governor at the time.
Is that the one where the guy was saying that he was now going to be in heaven? And
yeah, if there's anything that you can find in an amusing hanging story, mm-hmm. That one's pretty good, because he declared publicly from the gallows that he had been saved, and the chaplain or his minister escorted him to it, and he announced that people shouldn't worry about him, that he knew his soul was going to heaven. And immediately after he found out that he wasn't going to be hung, he danced a jig on the gallows and said to his buddies, "Boy, they almost sent me to hell."
We were talking earlier. The interesting thing about the way things have gone, and we were talking about our forefathers, the way they set up the rules for justice and those type things. And it was, they wanted it, anything like that, like an execution, to be public,
right?
Because they wanted to make sure that everything was done properly.
That's right. I mean, we think the public aspect of it was simply a matter of deterrent. I'm sure there was an element of that, but I mean, even today, you look at the oppressive, dictatorial societies around the world. If they've got a grievance against somebody, that person just disappears. And frequently the family never even knows what happened, whether they were given, you know, a fair hearing or anything else. So our founding fathers wrote rather explicitly that the dealing with crime and the assessment of punishment had to be a public activity. And as you say, a prime concern was they felt that that would make it more likely that the accused would get a fair opportunity. And if everybody was watching, there would be, you know, it would be done more appropriately.
Isn't it interesting, as they set the rules and the laws, there's always somebody out there that's going to take advantage of it. And of course, I'm not mentioning one group or anything like that, but I do want to mention the entrepreneurs, because a lot of people got rich off of executions, public hangings, because it was such a spectacle. And to this day, I don't know what would draw anybody to want to watch a man hang from a rope and kicking and see all those contortions that the body goes through. And a lot of times, like we were talking earlier, it's not an instant death.
No. And the law evolved in Tennessee was significant in several points there, and just what you're talking about was part of it. First, Tennessee set itself apart from at least the southern states back in the 1830s because the legislature changed the law and said, even in a capital murder case, we're going to give the jury and the judge discretion so he can consider mitigating circumstances. And if you count the number of executions that take place and then compare Tennessee to other states, you'll see that for that period there was quite a difference in Rutherford County. Indeed, I only found four executions in Rutherford County prior to the Civil War. Now, the Civil War brought a whole host of issues and executions and such that really didn't involve the justice system, as we call it, in the county.
Do you think the Civil War started a new standard on how we treated those type of situations?
Well, you know, from 1865, it was 25 years before there was another death sentence brought down in Rutherford County. And I do believe that probably the death and the killing and the destruction of that period made probably the population just more reluctant and more willing to use that mitigating circumstances to avoid it. But it did, and a quick story, what happened 25 years later, in about 1880, starting about 2 years before, as we would talk about today, a gang emerged in this area that was bent on theft and arson. In fact, their kind of modus operandi was they would break in, they would steal, and then they'd set fire. And this went on for 2 years, 78, 79, 80, such that the community was very edgy about it. And finally, one of their attempted robberies ended up in a death, a killing, and a rather prominent, I think he was actually a Confederate veteran, fairly prominent, was the victim. And they got the death sentence, the two of them. The names were John Hall and Burrell Smith, and they were part of this gang. Now, the gang was, I know, multiracial. It was not, you know, a racial thing. It was a gang, and I think they counted up eventually about 15 members because one of them turned state's evidence and named the members of the gang, and they all were eventually punished. But these two did get the death penalty. The sheriff, though, found that he had a real problem. The private property owners around the area said no, they didn't want a gallows built on their property. And the quarterly court said, no, we're not going to permit it on public property. You've got to go find somebody that'll let you. And finally, the sheriff did contract, and I forget the full name, but it was Mr. Kerr, K-E-R-R, and he owned the little island. And you look on a map, you can still find it. Or you can go walk Lytle Creek. There's a little island in the creek with water on both sides. And it's about between South Church and the railroad track right in there. In fact, just west of where the Church Street goes over the railroad. He agreed to let them use that island. So they went out and built the gallows on the island. And but once again, the curiosity brought out big crowds. And Mr. Kerr was an entrepreneur. He built grandstands on each side of the creek. He charged admission. He set up concessions. And the sheriff was, because he did it all on his property, the sheriff was at a loss as to how to control it. And that was the time when electricity was fascinating people. And someone approached the condemned men and said, we think that perhaps electric current can revive after death. And they agreed to let the...
one of them was the name Frankenstein, wasn't
it? Yeah, well, you can see where the stories come from. and, you know, you can make somebody twitch with an electric current. So the two condemned, who were grandstanders, I think, by nature, and they essentially convicted each other. You know, he said, I did it, and I said, you did it. But they applied the felony murder, since it was in the act of committing a felony anyway. Both of them were held responsible for the murder. They agreed to let them try to resurrect. So the people were coming not only to see an execution, they were coming thinking we just might see a resurrection, because as soon as the bodies were pronounced dead, they were going to hook them up and charge them and see, you know, what would happen. And there were stories in the media about in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, where this was actually happening and such. So it was going to be tried. It turned into such a circus that after the execution and before the resurrection, the people started crowding forward, splashing into the creek. The grandstands collapsed. Mm-hmm. No serious injuries, but, you know, just turned into chaos. At about the same time, there was a hanging up in Nashville that also turned into a circus. Shortly thereafter, the legislature said, that's it. Mm-hmm. From now on, executions, still the only method was hanging. Executions will be semi-private. And you can see they were still trying to preserve the public opportunity to see that things were done right.
Not let the pendulum go too far.
Right.
Yeah.
But things will be in private. And the sheriffs then were instructed that you can still build a gallows outdoors. Mm-hmm. People can still come and witness. But you had to drape the bottom of the gallows.
Hmm.
So that they could see the they could see the condemned man, they could hear his final words, they could hear the reading of the reason and complaint for the execution, but they couldn't see the drop or the death itself. And a number of different ways were tried, but you can see for a period there they were trying to preserve that, you know, so the public can see that things are being done right. But
whatever
the
dignity
time,
there is to an execution, they tried to maintain.
Yeah, to step back from the sensationalism and such. And that went on for about 1909. The legislature again stepped in and said, that's it. Executions are going to be done in the privacy of the prison in Nashville. So it essentially relieved the local sheriffs of the responsibility. Although early on, and I don't know what your experience was, but early on they still required the local county sheriff to be present in Nashville at the execution.
Right.
Yeah, I think that changed sometime later, but that was it. And again, it was so the folks back home could be reassured things were being done right. But they moved it all.
They let relatives and people like that directly close.
Yeah, they're always, well, as we've seen in the movies, there's always a limited number of witnesses to any execution, and it's again, so it's being done as it should be done.
Did they ever tackle one of the big issues of people profiteering off of executions?
They never, in Tennessee, there has never been any legislation, and of course when they put it in private, that pretty much, you know, took it into the penitentiary. But no, they continued to be outdoor spectacles and would draw huge crowds, even during the Civil War. And then, particularly, can you imagine, you and I, we're residents of Murfreesboro, very likely sympathizers with the Confederate cause. The occupying army is the one that's doing the executions.
Right.
And to some extent, I think the Union Army more or less said, you will be there. We want you to see. And there it was obviously part of kind of trying to keep the populace subdued. Here's the way we deal with our own deserters. Here's the way we deal with spies. Bragg, in most of the historic documents dealing with the execution, Bragg is not does not come off very attractive. He apparently was not able to exercise any kind of discretion. And, you know, you get the soldier gets a letter from his mother that his father died in desperate circumstances at home. Can you please come home and help? He walks off. He goes home. He takes care of Mama, and he comes back. Well, that would seem to me, be, you know, certainly due punishment.
Right.
But a strong mitigating circumstance. He comes back. And, you know, he went to do his domestic duty, and now he's back to continuing with his. Bragg was executing him for desertion, just, you know. In fact, he and General Breckinridge from Kentucky got very much at odds because...
I can see why.
Yeah, because of the execution of one of the Kentucky soldiers in exactly the type of circumstances I'm talking about.
But, you know, for you and I, that would be just a logical thing to do and a humane thing to do for mm-hmm. someone who was actually fighting for your cause. And he was willing to take all his responsibilities that was thrown at him, but he had a certain obligation he had to take care of, in which war and extraordinary type circumstances make people react differently mm-hmm. a lot of times, and some of them can keep their composure and do all the right things and rise to a heroic stance. And some just seem to fold they'll just throw anything to the wind regardless of what the circumstances are and who it's going to harm. And that's why history books are written, and that's why great novels are written. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the greatest circumstances that you and I know would be Sam Davis. I mean, the circumstances, as tragic as they were, I mean, he was given... A heroic, more like a symbol of the South's, resolve. Mm-hmm.
There were a number of spies, or those caught and executed as spies. I think the Sam Davis became a symbol partly because of his youth. Mm-hmm. I mean, here was a fellow who probably shouldn't have even been, put in those kind of circumstances. What we would call a teenager. And he was clearly given a chance to walk. And if you read the accounts, the Union general was sympathetic to the fact that he had essentially a kid there. And that gave him a chance to walk if he would just talk about who his associates were. And, he stood by very articulately, as we've seen. He stood by his honor there. But in reading about executions that took place in Murfreesboro, there was Bragg executed a local citizen, Samuel Gray, I believe was the name, mm-hmm. for being a spy. And Gray apparently also was tight-lipped and didn't give away any of his contacts or anything, and was very defiant. The news reports of that period, when they put the noose around his neck, he kind of spit in their face and jumped. He wasn't even going to give him a chance to hang him. He hung himself, literally, before him.
He almost got away, too, didn't he?
Yeah, close. I have never come across, except in the accounts of the executions, I've never come across anything about him. And it would seem to me that the Union, he was... Perhaps not as much, but he could also have been recognized as a heroic figure for the Union. Of course, he was obviously hung by the Confederate Army, so he was a spy against the Confederacy. But I'd be interested in knowing more details of that, but I wasn't able to find any more details. Just curious.
We have seen and heard of the horror, after the big wars, World War I, World War II, where people were made examples of, like we would be in the Philippines or one of the other countries, and those people that would support the Allied forces, they would be put up in front of all the people, the citizens who lived there, and they would be executed in front of them mm-hmm. to be made an example mm-hmm. of. Now, you don't think of that something that the people from this country could do or would ever do, especially to their own. But, when all of the prisoners were in the courthouse back during the war, and when they were captured, and the Southern prisoners, it's a good possibility that those prisoners were going to be executed as examples for all the people who lived in Murfreesboro.
Right, there would hardly have been any other reason, because it was early in the war, and I'm sure then it was a matter of rounding up all the suspicious characters kind of thing and making an example of them. And those who criticize Nathan Bedford Forrest need to appreciate that there would probably be a whole lot fewer people able to trace their ancestry back before the Civil War period, at least from Woodbury and Cannon County. That's where most of the prisoners came from. If Forrest had not cleared that jail and freed those prisoners.
And they were here in their homes, and they just happened to be on the wrong side as far as...
Right.
In the Civil War, and I always find it kind of confusing because there was absolutely nothing civil about the war. I mean, it was a war that was fought over economic situations more than it was anything back then at that time. It did go over toward the slavery side, but realistically it was over economics. And the sad thing about it, there were so many people that were killed by their own. It was almost like it was you're mass slaughtering your own family. And that's the one war that I've always felt a lot of empathy for the people, actually, in some ways, on both sides, because they were just like you and I. I mean, they were in there fighting for something they believed, but a lot of them were thrown in there just to fight for pretty much like they were drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the affluent people in the North, if they had enough money, they could buy their way out, and,
right.
and somebody would have to take their place.
Right, and if you ever read a roster of some of the Union, it's an awful lot of immigrants,
mm-hmm.
people just arriving in the country.
A lot of Irish.
Yeah, a lot of German.
Yep.
In fact, when Rosecrans was here with his encampment, we had the largest Catholic population I think we've ever had in this area. In fact, the first Catholic services in Rutherford County were for Rosecrans, who was himself Catholic. But it was largely because of all the East European and Southern European immigrants that were the Catholic, of Catholic faith.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Greg Tucker.
Hi, this is Chuck Lewis with First Bank in Murfreesboro.
And Jim Bryan of First Bank in Smyrna.
Did you know that Social Security and other federal benefits are moving to a paperless system?
If you're currently receiving a paper check from the government and want to know more about how you can make the transition to direct deposit, stop by your local First Bank branch or call 890-1111 in Murfreesboro or 267-1111 in Smyrna.
That's 890-1111 or 267-1111. First Bank, member FDIC.
This is Sean Brown at Southeastern Tire Service, where we now offer the Michelin Promise Plan. The Michelin Promise Plan is a new offer which includes a 30-day ride guarantee, 3-year flat tire changing assistance, and a limited mileage warranty on all Michelin passenger and light truck tires, replacement and original equipment. Did you know we now provide air conditioning service? Let our ASC certified technicians get your car road ready today.
Southeastern Tire Service on Broad Street across from Advance Auto.
Guardian has over 125 years combined experience in security, fire, camera systems, and access control for your home and business. Contact Guardian at 459-1040 at mygss.com.
Guardian, we help you keep your guard up.
459-1040.
Hello, this is Jim Bryan at First Bank.
And I'm Chuck Lewis. First Bank presents Good Neighbor Events, news of what our local schools, churches, and community groups are doing.
Well, here it is Tuesday, July 26th. Good Neighbor Events brought to you by First Bank. There's a free ACT-SAT workshop tonight over at the Patterson Community Center. Tonight's one-hour session deals with question challenges. Registration is required. Call them now at 907-3429. That's 5 o'clock tonight in the Myrtle Glanton Lord Library of the Patterson Community Center. And from 6 until 8 tonight, as well as on Monday and Thursday evenings, the Murfreesboro Blue Raiders youth football and cheerleading registration over at McKnight Field. That's next to SportsCom. This is open to children ages 5 to 12. Sign-ups are every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday evening from 6 until 8 in the evening through August 4th. If you have any questions, phone 346-2822. And sadly, this is the final week of the Murfreesboro Parks and Recreation Department's Movies Under the Stars for the season. Tonight, it's over at the Cannonsburg Pioneer Village at 8:30, and the flick is The Karate Kid. Oh, this reminder, the Rutherford County Agricultural Extension Service is offering one of their brown bag lunches this Thursday morning at 11:30 over at the Lane Agripark. The topic is special needs and small space gardening, as well as herb and butterfly gardens. It's all free. The brown bag lunch, 11:30 this coming Thursday at the Lane Agripark. And on hot days, be sure to check with your senior citizen friends and loved ones. Fans and air conditioners definitely do save lives. If you need one, call Dwight Ogleton at the Cool Aid Program, 818-2459. Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by First Bank.
Weather Eye.
Mainly sunny this afternoon, high in the mid-90s. Tonight, clear, low of 72. Sunny on Wednesday, high of 97. Wednesday night, mainly clear, low of 74. I'm WGNS meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Right now, it's 91.
Did you get a sad face after your emissions test?
Come by Todd's Complete Auto Care and we'll get your car to pass and put a smile on your face.
This is Amy at Todd's Complete Auto Care Center. We'll even take it through emissions for you.
Todd's Complete Auto Care on Southeast Broad, across from the Discovery Center.
Come see me.
It's the Truman Show, a look at the people and news shaping Rutherford County with Truman Jones.
And today's guest, Mr. Greg Tucker.
And want to let you know that part of the second half of the show will be brought to you by At Home Care. And their location is at 237 Castlewood Drive, Suite H, like in Henry, right behind the Kroger's on Memorial Boulevard. And you can reach them at 713-4639 or on the internet at www.athomecaretennessee.com. And this is Melissa Warren's business, and she was on with us last week. And what a delightful lady and a real caring lady. And what she felt like that a need in this community was not being addressed, and that was for the people who have become older or maybe were having certain medical issues that they couldn't take care of their home properly or their normal business. And what she decided to do is she started a business where she can go into a person's house and do errands, laundry, personal needs, light housekeeping, transportation to appointments, grocery shopping, meal preparation, medication reminders, and many, many other things. And she does this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And her number one goal is that people can still maintain a quality way of life and stay in their home and still be able to take care of themselves the way that they need to be done with a little assistance. And I commend Melissa for starting that business. And you and I are going to be that way one of these days. In fact, we're not too far behind it the way we are today.
Yeah, I hope we can afford good care.
One of the interesting articles that you had in here was a slave lady named Sarah.
Yeah, and one of the questions or points people frequently raise, has there ever been a woman executed? Well, yes, in Rutherford County, there was one woman who was given the death penalty. And this is one where the crime was very brutal. Apparently, she broke into the home of an elderly lady who was asleep and using a hammer bashed her head in. And then to try to cover the crime, I guess, she placed the body so that the head was in the fire. And when the body was found, the account says the head was almost totally consumed. The purpose was theft, and soon after they discovered the crime, the authorities had found Sarah, and she had in her possession things stolen from the home. And, you know, it's probably an example of some of the fastest move to justice. I hope not a rush to justice, because the facts were fairly clear and certain, but they had her on the gallows within 3 months after the crime was discovered. So, and also, as I said, there's only about four or five executions that took place in this county before the Civil War. But one of those is a pretty good example of the downside of capital punishment, and that is we're human, we make mistakes. A fellow was executed for rape. He claimed his innocence to the gallows, but the evidence against him was what we today call circumstantial. In other words, there was good reason to believe that he could have and probably did commit the crime, but there was no witness and no what we call today forensic evidence or, you know, conclusive evidence. But it seemed like he was the guilty party, and he was condemned. Not long after he had been hung, another fella confessed to the crime. And it turns out the fellow who confessed was a serial criminal, had committed a similar crime in several other jurisdictions before they finally caught up with him. So it's a mistake that can't be corrected. And
you know, it's very difficult in today's time to actually go for the death penalty or get the death penalty, because it's a tremendous amount of research work that has to be done to maintain the guilt or innocence of that individual who is charged with the crime. And you see these movies sometimes where they sent the wrong person to jail or to the death penalty for a capital crime. But I can tell you that's far and few between, because law enforcement uses every resource that it can to not only prosecute that individual, but also if there's maybe an element of innocence there, they work hard on both sides, because nobody wants to send the wrong person to the death chamber or to spend the rest of his life in the penitentiary, whichever one is worse.
Well, you remind me of one of the, what would you call it, ideological elements of death penalty in this country, and that is it's not intended to be and is not hopefully ever used as vengeance.
Right.
I mean, we talk about closure for the victims or the family of the victims, but, I mean, in this country, who brings the charges against an accused? It's the state.
Right.
And we have a special prosecutor or a district attorney or someone who does that, so you don't have the victim or the victim's family or victim interests, you know, going after vengeance. Obviously, it's hard to take that human nature out of it, but that's important. And that is one reason today you frequently, when even a clear eyewitness kind of case will be appealed, and it throws off on the legal profession. Mm-hmm. Because even those who are guilty of the crime, there are legal rights available to them that can spare them the death penalty, such as incompetence. And so almost every death penalty case now, there will at some point be an appeal based on inadequacy of counsel, which I've never represented anyone in a capital case, but I can imagine that would be kind of a tough on your ego to have done all you could to try to get him off.
I have seen cases when it was deserved, and I have seen cases when it wasn't deserved.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, if I was going to be charged with a crime and I was innocent, that would be the crime I would want, because there'll be more emphasis placed mm-hmm. on trying to make sure mm-hmm. that person is either innocent or guilty. And if you've ever noticed, and you said you've never tried a capital punishment case, but I can tell you that law enforcement, professional law enforcement officials and detectives will give very little information to the press. And the reason that is done is to keep away what we had talked about earlier, a carnival atmosphere where mm-hmm. the person is judged by the press and by the public before he or she ever gets to court. And really, they don't have the information available to be making those decisions.
You remind us again of another. We change venues frequently in capital cases because of just that. We don't want the prosecuting side to be under political or public pressure to press for capital punishment or to even do something that would be inappropriate because mm-hmm. of those pressures. I think on the whole, in this country, we do a pretty fair job. In my lifetime, there have been a few where I felt like maybe the incompetence issue was still there. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting case of a deserter executed out on Cripple Creek. There was one of the batteries was out on Cripple Creek, and this fella walked away, and they hadn't seen or heard from him, and then there was a skirmish, and he was wounded slightly and captured by, and they found out that he had walked away and joined the Confederate forces just down the road. Mm-hmm. And he was shot for desertion. One of his colleagues wrote home and said this fellow didn't know what was going on. He was physically very weak, but he also was feeble-minded. Mm-hmm. And clearly didn't have any idea that he had done the wrong thing. Didn't appreciate the seriousness of what was going on at all. Well, today that would have been considered as mitigating factors.
Right.
And very unlikely that, you know, he would have been executed for desertion if something like that could be shown. So our treatment has evolved over time, and part of it is part of the frustration. It takes so long to exhaust all those issues before we execute somebody.
Learn from our experiences.
Yeah.
Sometimes we go too far, sometimes we don't go far enough, but on the whole, I think that the process has improved drastically. And I can relate one situation that I'm extremely familiar with, where we had a young couple, a young boy, murdered a young girl here in Rutherford County. And we worked the case, and we spent endless hours and days and weeks and months on this case, and built up a circumstantial case on this individual. He had a very good attorney who protected him well, and that was his job. And it just went on, and the DA at that time, Guy Dotson, he worked hard on it with us. And the information that we developed was a fairly good case. But it was not a case where you knew 100% at the time that you were going to be able to go in and get a judgment at that time. And as you well know, if we didn't win the first time, most right. people don't realize that you don't get a second chance. He can come out and confess the next day that I murdered her. And that's tough luck, you know. That's one of the strange quirks of the law. You've only got one chance, which I can understand the process. But I gained so much respect for Guy Dotson during that trial. I already had a lot of respect for him anyway, because he's one of the brightest attorneys I've ever known. And as a DA, we were very blessed. And of course, with Bill Weitzel now, we're very blessed to have him too. That's one of the things about experience, knowledge, and having the forethought to be able to handle cases like that that most people wouldn't want to tackle. But as it turned out, years went by, and he still did not feel like comfortable enough to take that case to court. As technology changed, we were able to just downright prove that mm-hmm. this person committed the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And what it did was it proved him right by waiting. What's the old book? Don't rush to judgment. He would not rush to judgment, even though it would probably have been politically the right thing to do. But he knew that it was not the right thing to do as far as the law was concerned. And I think that's part of the improvement that we have made, because we've had people like him, whose probably name will not go down in history like some of these other people, but it's people like him that have shown us the right thing to do.
People frequently don't appreciate that our system gives the prosecutor a great deal of discretion. It's called prosecutorial discretion. And I've seen many circumstances where the prosecutor says, I think a crime was committed here, and now this would not be in a capital case kind of thing. But the circumstances, which can be, you know, the burden that would be imposed on the public, the cost of going forward, the circumstances of the accused, and they'll elect not to prosecute. Mm-hmm. And there was a very prominent cases up in Washington, D.C., some of the special prosecutor cases, and Jim McKay was the prosecutor. And I believe it was the banker out of Georgia. Hmm. And he did the investigation. He was from the firm I was with up there, and he essentially said that. He says, "Yeah, there was a crime committed here, but the consequences of it were slight, and the individual has paid in loss of esteem and such already, and I'm just not going to prosecute it." And walked away from it. But what you described was very good use of that discretion. We're not going to prosecute it now because we're not going to be able to make our case. Mm-hmm. And boy, technology has changed so dramatically. DNA, don't ask me what that stands for, but DNA testing now has changed from purely circumstantial cases to cases with hard, indisputable scientific evidence. And
what you're going to see is a lot in the next 20 years. A lot of the old crimes that were committed in the past, you're not going to see that with them having to go back and use all that time again.
The cold case files will be much thinner.
Yeah.
Yeah, much thinner.
But you'll see that cases that will be committed, crimes will be committed, those cases will be solved quicker, but it won't cause what we call the rush to judgment syndrome either, because we will never see a time when people are sentenced for crimes they did not commit.
I hope that's the way we're moving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another interesting connection that Rutherford County has to the evolution of death penalties in Tennessee. I was saying in 1909, they said, back in the 1880s, they said they're going to be semi-private. In 1909, they moved them into the penitentiary and made them closed activity, not open to the public, only those designated witnesses. The first one to be executed under those circumstances was a crime committed in Rutherford County. He was the station agent at the railroad station in Florence, which at the time was a significant community. It had its own little railroad stop up there. He was a station agent. And he lived in a boarding house maybe 100 yards from the station. And one of his fellow boarders ran a little store there in that same community. And apparently he began to think that that fella sat on a lot of cash and attempted a robbery, and the robbery went bad. And he and the storekeeper ended up in a struggle, a fight. And I'll have to review the facts again as to who actually had the gun originally. But the gun went off, and the storekeeper died. And again, it was felony murder, a death in connection with a felony crime. And he was hung in the penitentiary in about late 1909. And it's interesting that that only went on for 4 years, because in 1913 they said no more hangings and they switched to the chair. And of course, you and I now look at the chair as a rather barbaric way.
Yeah.
if hanging was barbaric, the chair wasn't a whole lot of an improvement.
And we will talk about that when we come back. We're going to take a quick break.
All right.
Murfreesboro Medical Clinic is more than just a clinic. It's the doctors you can trust, a technician you can believe in, and a staff member who goes the extra mile. From the time someone walks in our doors, the difference becomes evident. All of our resources are used to improve the healthcare experience of our patients, and we have been a part of Rutherford and surrounding counties for over 60 years. Murfreesboro Medical Clinic.
Murfreesboro Medical Clinic.
Hey, this is Tom over at Kirk & Burt's. Today's special is our barbecue sandwiches for $1.50. You can add a piece of homemade pie for a full, healthy meal. Kirk & Burt's. 517 Cason Lane, just past the theater. Or call in your order, 893-FOOD.
Did you know a vehicle you buy from Stan McNabb Chevrolet Cadillac Buick GMC and Stan McNabb Jeep Dodge Chrysler in Tullahoma, and even Stan McNabb Ford in Lewisburg, and a vehicle you buy from another dealership, they may look alike, But the truth is, they're very different. Only the new or pre-owned vehicle from Stan McNabb has oil changes and tires for life at no additional charge. Check it out at stanmcnabb.com. See dealer for complete details.
Hi, I'm Dr. Britt Miaton, a cardiologist with St. Thomas Heart at Middle Tennessee Medical Center. Did you know that St. Thomas Heart is Middle Tennessee's number one rated heart program? At MTMC, we offer comprehensive services for the treatment and prevention of heart disease. From early diagnosis to minimally invasive surgical procedures, St. Thomas Heart at MTMC offers you heart care close to home. For information, visit heartasone.com or call 867-5028.
He knows Rutherford County as good as anybody. Truman Jones. It's the Truman Show here on WGNS AM and FM.
All right, we're right back with Greg Tucker, and we were talking about ways of execution and hanging. Of course, there was a lot of activity going on during a hanging, and you think of that. Well, it's too bad, so too vicious. So let's go to something else. And you went to the old Sparky and started sending electricity running through a person's body, and I can't think of anything that would hurt more than that. But you came up with an interesting concept when we were talking earlier, and I agree with you. It looks gross and awful, but the French really had it right when they developed the guillotine.
Well, that was certainly a clean, immediate way to end a life. And I've wondered, you know, it was never considered here. We never, and it may be that just we are averse to making a mess, because obviously there's going to be something of a mess to clean up after you use a guillotine. You know, that was one of the biggest criticisms of the electric chair.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the body frequently was damaged in such a way.
Didn't do it correctly, it caused all kinds of problems.
And the lethal injection. Now, there are those who say, you know, why should we be concerned about, you know, we're executing someone who we've decided deserves to die.
Did something horrible to another person.
Yeah, and with our system now, he's had every conceivable chance to avoid that. So why should we be concerned? And I think that's our... at least our nature as a, you know, a civilized society here.
You know, sometimes we bring things on ourselves with unknowingly because of our habits or because of what we do. You were talking about the gentleman that over in the Florence community,
mm-hmm.
That lost his life because there was talk going on that he had money. I can think of a couple of other incidences that happened here. One in Eagleville where the store owners there were robbed, and to this date don't know how much money those people got, but it was thought that they had money, as the old saying, buried away. And,
right.
And then we had an elderly couple over on the south side that were murdered by people that knew them, young people, and they were murdered because they were known to keep money on them rather than keep it in banks, and that's one thing that people need to know, that not flash anything of value around at all.
I remember that latter case talking about very specifically is down in our direction,
right,
at Bradable
Pike. Right.
And then there's the famous case of String Bean and his wife too, was exactly the same.
Very similar to that one.
Yeah, they believed that he, in his case, they actually thought he carried it on his person. And, you know, waited for him to come home.
And he did.
And,
But they didn't find it.
Yeah.
And that case just came up for review, mm-hmm. for parole for Mr. Brown, who was one of the assailants. And, of course, they turned him down on the initial try. So
right.
I don't think that one's over with yet. But hopefully that will stay on.
And let's see, I was curious as to when was the last, and of course I'm dealing with history, but in the 20th century, the last Rutherford County native to die in the electric chair was a fellow, his nickname was Bantam, last name was Du Bois. He was the son of a tenant farmers in this area. And again, was the accounts you read, he was one that, well, he had already been convicted of murder and had served a shorter sentence and had gotten out, and just a brutal personality. The crime actually took place over on, I think it was 118 Vine, West Vine, East Vine, the Deluxe Cab Company. And I don't think Du Bois was a cabbie. I think he just hung out over there. Mm-hmm. But he was offended because he thought one of the cabbies had ratted on him, was his phrase, in connection with some illicit drug or alcohol or something like that. Mm-hmm. And goaded the fella, trying to get him to fight, and the fella would not respond. And finally, just deciding, well, he's not going to fight, Du Bois split his head with a kitchen knife, a butcher knife. And he had an accomplice, had two accomplices, but he did at his trial. And he was apparently the type of personality that wanted to be the center of attention. And he said, no, those two fellows didn't have anything to do with it. I did it all myself. So he was the only one that paid the price. But he was executed in about 1948. And for the next 52 years, there were no executions in connection with Rutherford County crime.
But, you know, people today still remembers his, they still remember his name.
Is that
right? And it seems like that he made quite an impact on this community, and that goes back to say, well, people commit crimes, they commit murders, but the thing that really draws the attention that makes it more newsworthy for the future is the execution and what happens to them when they go to court. It's not the crime, it seems to, you know, we think back to Lizzie Borden and all the things that she did, and some crimes that it seem like they've become legendary. But it doesn't seem like that happens until what happens to that individual when he goes to court. And it seems to put a stamp on it.
Well, what happens to the body after an execution? In Tennessee, the family can claim the body. And in the case of Du Bois, it did. His body came back to Tennessee, and the family actually had a wake, put the casket on the dining room table in their small little house. But many of them, the state is responsible. For instance, the woman we were talking about, you read the quarterly court minutes, they allocated $3 for her casket and burial. Because
do you think we can use $3 now?
I think we could buy anything for $3 now.
I was looking at that, and that blew me away. Yeah. $3 for the whole thing.
Well, for $5, they could build a gallows. Labor was cheap, I guess. The sheriff actually was compensated. $12.50 was probably a good month's salary that he got in addition to his regular salary for being the...
Wow, I didn't know a sheriff made that much.
Yeah. You don't remember getting those kind of bonuses?
I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up. Greg, it's another great show, and I look forward to being on with you again Tuesday week. And got any idea what we're going to cover then?
I have no idea. We'll just
we never know what we're going to cover when we come in here, do we?
Sometimes I think about it before I get here, but...
And then I get you off target.
Yeah, and then you'll...
I am so sorry about that. People say, why don't you just let Greg talk and you just shut up?
No. I like the way you lead me. Then I know what's interesting.
Well, we will see you tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and... Especially you sports fans now, Mr. Raymond Berry is going to be on the show tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and everybody remembers the great duo between he and Johnny Unitas with the old Baltimore Colts, one of the greatest teams in the history of the NFL, and one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. See you tomorrow at 2.